Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Faith Perlow, and Dan Novak. Brian's story considers how long it will take for Florida schools damaged by the recent hurricane to reopen. Faith looks at a plan in Australia to protect the country's unique plant and animal population. Dan discusses the waxworm moth and how it might limit plastic pollution. After that, Jill Robbins and I bring you the Higher Education Report. Based on Nobel Prize winners, should students center their studies on only one topic? Later on, Anna Mateo's words and their stories tells you how to prevent your buttons from getting pushed. And now, here's Brian Lynn.
Damage from Hurricane Ian has led to school closures in some parts of Florida. The situation has parents wondering when and how their children will be able to return to classrooms. Rescue and recovery operations are continuing in areas affected by the storm in southwestern Florida. Several school systems in the area cannot yet say when they will be ready to reopen. Some schools are without power and are still examining the damage from Ian. Officials are also trying to find out how many teachers and other employees will not be able to return to work. Experts say long-term school shutdowns can have a harmful effect on students. In a week or two, we'll have forgotten about Hurricane Ian. But these districts and schools and students will be struggling months and years later, said Cassandra R. Davis. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Public Policy at the University of North Carolina. Florida's Department of Education said recently that 68 of the state's 75 school districts were open for in-person classes, with two more expected to reopen soon. Abby Tarr Trembley is a mother of four in Sarasota. She told the Associated Press that her youngest child, a 9-year-old boy, asks each day when he can go back to school. Every morning he's like, "Mom, is it a school day? Is it a school day?" she said. Trembley added, "Every morning I'm almost in tears." The hurricane damaged the top of her house and the family lost power for 3 days. She was thankful the damage was not worse, but she has begun to worry about the effects on her children and their education. Her son already repeated first grade to help him make up for school closures during the COVID-19 pandemic. Online learning has increased in recent years for schools dealing with natural disasters and the coronavirus pandemic. But researchers have said studies show that online learning over long periods can be difficult for children. The University of North Carolina's Davis has studied how Hurricane Matthew in 2016 and Hurricane Florence in 2018 affected student learning in the southeastern U.S. She said research suggests some elementary students continued to fall behind in school up to 2 years after a storm. Students who had wealthy parents or were in districts with healthy budgets were more likely to recover faster, the research showed. Workers in affected areas are repairing damage inside schools. But for now, officials say flooding on some streets has made it unsafe for students and families to reach the area. School leaders are also trying to find out which teachers and employees will not be able to return when schools reopen. Some schools will be closed for up to a week, while others will take longer to reopen. Trembley said she had heard that when schools do start back up, classes will take place online. But she hopes that is not the case. There's no way that I can assist a 9-year-old with schoolwork and continue my job, she said. A study found that when Hurricane Katrina hit the southern U.S. in 2005, some students faced displacement for a very long time. In some cases, it took 6 months for children to be resettled. This led to a drop in test scores in that first year, said Bruce Sacerdote, an economist at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. He added, not only do they have to move their home, but they're even out of school for some time. I'm Brian Lynn.
Australia's Environment Minister said on Tuesday it will set aside at least 30% of its landmass for conservation. Tanya Plibersek said the plan will help protect plants and animals on the continent where many animals are found nowhere else. Australia has lost more mammal species than any other continent. And an Australian government environmental report released in July showed that the country has one of the worst rates for species loss among the world's richest nations. That report showed the number of species added to the list of threatened species, or in a higher class of risk, grew on average by 8% from the former report in 2016. Plibersek said, "The need for action to protect our plants, animals, and ecosystems from extinction has never been greater." Plibersek said the conservation areas will increase by 50 million hectares under the 10-year plan, which will be re-examined in 2027. The recently elected federal Labor government has set $146 million to help protect Australia's threatened native plants and animals. Australia is the 6th largest country by land area in the world. And it is home to animals found nowhere else. Those animals include koalas and platypus. But their numbers have been falling due to extreme weather events and humans moving into areas where they live. Koalas, along much of the East Coast, were listed as endangered in February. This was after nature experts estimated Australia has lost about 30% of its koalas over the past 4 years. Australia suffers extreme weather events on a usual basis. Such happenings include the deadly wildfires in 2019 and 2020 in the east that killed 33 people, billions of animals, and burned a huge area. The nonprofit group World Wildlife Fund Australia has welcomed the government's conservation efforts, but it is also urging officials to invest in recovery plans for every threatened species. Rachel Lowry is the group's chief conservation officer. She said Australia has more than 1,900 listed threatened species. This plan picks 110 winners. It's unclear how it will help our other non-priority threatened species. I'm Faith Perlow.
Researchers have found that a chemical from a kind of worm can break down one of the most common forms of plastic. The finding could open up new ways to deal with plastic pollution. There have been several studies showing that microorganisms can release enzymes that cause the plastic polyethylene to start to degrade. But that process takes a long time. Around one-third of plastic waste is polyethylene. The recently discovered enzymes were found in the saliva of the wax worm moth. They appear to act in only a few hours. Federica Bertucchini is one of the researchers who helped write a study on the finding at the Margarita Salas Center for Biological Studies, or CIB, in Madrid, Spain. She is also a beekeeper. She said she got the idea for the research while storing honeycombs a few years ago. Honeycombs are built by bees to store honey. Bertocchini told AFP that 1 year, she found her honeycombs full of waxworms. She cleaned the honeycombs and put the worms in a plastic bag. When she returned later, she found the bag was full of holes. She wondered if the worms were eating the plastic, or if there was a chemical reaction that caused the holes. We checked that, doing proper lab experiments, and we found that the polyethylene had been oxidized, she said. In her latest research, Bertocchini and her co-workers identified two enzymes in the worm's saliva. The enzymes appeared to break down polyethylene in only a few hours at room temperature. The group published their research recently in Nature Communications. In the study, they explained how they used another worm's saliva as a control in the experiment. The control worm produced no result compared with the waxworm's saliva. Bertocchini said her team is still trying to understand how the worms degrade the plastic. They said much more research is needed before the findings can be used to process plastic waste. However, Bertocchini said the enzymes could be put into a water mixture and then put over piles of collected plastic in a waste center. She said that in the future, the enzyme could be used in homes where each family could degrade their own plastic waste. I'm Dan Novak.
Experts often tell students to center their efforts on a narrow field to get a job after school. But recent research into Nobel Prize winners suggests that wider interests are important. One of the winners of this year's Nobel Prize in chemistry was Danish scientist Morten Meldahl. He received the award with two other chemists for their work on click chemistry. Click chemistry describes when scientists create materials, such as polymers, that join molecules together, even in living things. Meldahl is 68 years old and works at the University of Copenhagen. When describing his career, Meldahl said he started out as an engineer, but changed to chemistry because he wanted to understand the world. In a discussion with the Nobel Prize organization, he talked about his co-winner, Carolyn Bertozzi of Stanford University. He said, "She has such a broad knowledge of both chemistry and biology, and she knows how to utilize her knowledge in a very exquisite way." Meldahl's experience and the way he sees things may come as a surprise to students. They might believe they have to center their work and school lives in one field to be successful. But a study from professors at Michigan State University shows that is not always the case.
Michelle Root Bernstein and Robert Root Bernstein published their study this spring in the Creativity Research Journal. They said that a large number of Nobel Prize winners can be described as polymaths. Polymaths are people who have many different interests in both their work and personal lives. Sometimes they are called Renaissance men or women. That is another way of describing a person who knows a lot about many different fields. The writers looked at past Nobel Prize winners and their students. They decided that when students of winners go on to win Nobel Prizes, some of what they learned from their teachers is how to live a life with many interests. They are, in a way, learning how to be creative. Having many interests, the Root Bernsteins wrote, permits scientists to look for creative ways to solve problems. In fact, one important part of science is not discovering answers, but recognizing problems that need to be solved. The prize winners, the Root Bernstein said, transfer skills, techniques, and materials from one field to another. They said Alexis Carrel won his Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1912 by using techniques he learned from the clothing business. He realized that people who used thread to make and fix clothing had a skill that could be used in operations to put new organs into people's bodies.
In 1978, a professor from Carnegie Mellon University in Pennsylvania won the Nobel Prize in Economics. His name was Herbert Simon. He worked in many parts of the university during his career and supported projects in computer science, artificial intelligence, psychology, philosophy, and economics. Outside of work, he played piano, wrote music, painted, made drawings, and played chess. In a book he wrote about his life, Simon said, "I can rationalize any activity I engage in as simply another form of research." One winner in medicine, Christiane Nusslein-Volhard, said in 2003 that she is very curious and "I like to understand things." She won her prize in 1995 for work she did on genetic controls in the early development of the embryos of insects and fish. But during some parts of her life, she made games called puzzles, drew pictures, and wrote a cookbook. In 2017, she told young scientists to avoid following the mainstream and move out of their study areas in order to be independent and original. The Michigan State professors study creativity. They found that most professionals are not like the prize winners. The prize winners are special in that they regularly look for the chances to learn new things, even outside of their jobs. Nobel winners are 9 times more likely to have experience in working with wood, metal, or in the arts than most scientists. The writers also found that even those who win in a field like economics have experience in other areas. Some of the economics winners studied math, physics, and astronomy before doing their economics research.
The Michigan State researchers say that the Nobel winners have an open mind about their life experiences. Unlike many people who spend long hours at work and give up some of their outside interests, Nobel winners believe their hobbies are important to creativity. Dario Fo won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1997. He talked about drawing and painting as a way to solve problems that came up in his writing. "When I'm having difficulty with a play, I stop writing, so I can draw out the action in pictures," he said. The researchers say that, even among people who do not win big prizes, those with many interests are often successful. They pointed to a 2012 report about students who study 2 major fields in college. That study plan is called a double major. The writers from Vanderbilt University in Tennessee said double majors are often more creative and more interested in starting their own businesses than those who centered on only 1 study area. Other researchers have found that having an outside activity that makes you think can help predict future success in a job. Some of those activities include playing chess, performing music, or creating art. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. The world is filled with buttons. Some buttons we press, such as the ones needed to operate a vehicle or machinery. Some buttons fasten our clothes. They keep our shirts closed and our pants from falling down. In English, the word button is found in many useful and common expressions. Let's talk about the kinds of buttons you press or push. Young children like to push buttons, even if nothing happens. There is something very satisfying about pushing a button. Well, did you know that people have buttons too? However, these buttons are not physical things. Our buttons activate or trigger our feelings. They are things to which we feel sensitive. So, some unkind people may find it satisfying to push people's buttons. If you push someone's buttons, you do something or talk about something that upsets them. Button pushers like to upset people by bringing up sore subjects. For example, a woman I used to know always tried to push my buttons by bringing up an old boyfriend. But then finally, I told her I did not care. After that, she stopped trying to push the old boyfriend button. However, pushing someone's buttons can also happen accidentally. Sometimes we don't mean to, but we can bring up an issue that is touchy to someone else. Now, let's talk about the kind of buttons on clothing. As you know already, buttons are fasteners on our clothes. They keep them shut. Well, imagine if our mouths had buttons. We could fasten them shut to keep silent. And that gives us some impolite expressions. They all mean to be quiet. If I tell someone to button their mouth, button their lip, or to simply button it, I am telling them to shut up. Like I said, the expressions are rude. But there is another way we use button in our conversations. For a button on our clothing to work, it needs a buttonhole. Otherwise, you can't fasten them. A buttonhole traps the button. So if you buttonhole someone in a conversation, you trap them. Like a button that has slipped into a buttonhole, they cannot escape. Now, you can buttonhole someone with a fun topic, but usually we use this term when someone talks to you for a long time about something you don't want to hear. If you are buttonholed over an unpleasant topic, you can also say that someone had you cornered. Now, let's hear some of these terms used between two friends.
Where have you been? I've been looking all over for you. Have you tried the cake? It is so good.
I haven't had anything to eat or drink yet. Jen had me buttonholed for an hour about her work project.
Not cool. A party is not the place to corner someone about work.
And she knows I wanted to work on that project.
Really not cool. She just wants to push your buttons. And you're too nice to tell her to button it. Are you still upset about the project?
No, I'm over it. And I told her. I also told her that I don't want to talk about work anymore at a party.
Good. Not caring is the best way to deal with a button pusher. Uh-oh. Look over there. Now she's got David buttonholed.
Poor guy. But he can take care of himself. Now, where is that cake you were talking about?
Brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Thank you, Ana. And that's the Learning English broadcast for today. Thanks to my colleagues, Brian Lynn, Faith Perlow, Dan Novak, and Jill Robbins. And thank you for listening. You can learn more about us at learningenglish.voanews.com. Be sure to join us again tomorrow to keep learning English with stories from around the world. I'm Dan Friedel.